Good morning, and welcome to Talking About California. Here we continue our series of discussions with Californians who talk about this place, this state, California, their home, and their work here in California. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. Our guest this morning is Jim Davis. Good morning.
Good morning, Cal.
Let me introduce you for a minute, Jim. Jim is a writer and a filmmaker and a Bay Area activist. He was born in County Kildare in Ireland, one of seven children. He studied there at Trinity College in Dublin. He studied economics and philosophy. As a student, he was active in various campaigns, and he was a defendant in the infamous, he says. I'm not sure I should ask you about this. It may not be so infamous in this part of the world, but the infamous case taken up by SPUC. What's that?
Society for the Protection of the Unborn Child.
Right. Against student
pro-life groups.
Right. Against student leaders, and that was at Trinity, I guess, to prevent them from distributing information on how to access abortion services in the UK. Jim moved to California in 1994, where he has worked various jobs in San Francisco and made a series of short films. These include Anatomy, Autonomy, and A Song, a film made in Oaxaca, Mexico. Safety Orange, a film about architecture and incarceration in the U.S. I won't say too much about them because we'll come back to them. And Meeting Room, a film that looks at the controversial history of concerned parents against drugs, a movement in Dublin during the 1980s. Jim's a writer as well. I'll just limit this to his latest contribution to the new PM Press book, Catastrophism. We'll spend some time on that this morning. And he's also written about the political limitations of NGOs. Jim, if it's okay with you, let me ask you about becoming a Californian. I taught for many years in the City University of New York, and most of my students were new immigrants. They often came from places that are tourist destinations for Americans. And I always wondered about, you know, coming to places like New York City. And New York's not California, but I could never get the truth out of most of them about what they thought about it all, but it was pretty clear they had some doubts. So California's not New York, but why did you come here from such a lovely place, deeply loved, the beautiful island of Ireland?
Well, I first came over in 1994, and I'd been out of college for a couple of years at that point, living in Dublin, also living for some time in Berlin. And, you know, I think it was just the beginning of the Celtic Tiger. So the economy was sort of picking up for the first time in a long time. There'd been, like, my childhood was basically in this sort of long, drawn-out recession, very high unemployment, immigration, very much a fact of life for young people. People would leave school, leave college, and take the boat to go to England or go to, like you say, go to New York, and also people went to the States. And I didn't really, you know, at the time the economy was picking up, like I say, so it wasn't really about work, I think, the reason I left. I kind of left to get out of this sort of small place where I'd been very active and, you know, doing a lot of stuff over the previous number of years. I didn't feel like I was leaving for good, you know. But I had spent a lot of time with, you know, as a teenager and so on, working in the summers in Germany or working in France. And so I was pretty used to traveling, and I liked the idea of getting out of Dublin for a while. So I got a green card in a lottery. At the time, there were these lotteries where they were giving away green cards to, Irish people got, I don't remember the exact number, but it was a huge number of these green card, you know, qualifications. I mean, pretty much everybody who applied for one got one. And so I got a green card. My sister actually sent in the application form on my behalf. I was out of the country, and I wasn't that motivated to come to the States myself, but she sent it in. I got one, so I decided to follow some friends over to San Francisco. I had a lot of friends in New York, and then some of my friends were in San Francisco, and I decided to come over to this side of the country rather than go to New York. I figured New York was a little bit of a cliche for Irish people, as was Boston. So So I thought it'd be more interesting to go to San Francisco.
So you did, did it seem a little crazy over here to you when you, started settling in?
I mean, it's pretty interesting to come to the I'd never been to the U.S. before, so, but it was all very familiar from, you know, American cultural exports, you know, from movies and books and so on, and just so the imagery is so, like, iconical, you know, that it felt very familiar to me. And then a lot of my Irish mates, a lot of people I'd been in school with or college with, they're just new from, I was involved in music a lot in Dublin, so a lot of my old music buddies, you know, were in San Francisco. So, you know, we had club nights, we were DJing, we had our own kind of culture going on. And then sort of slowly, I guess, I became immersed in the local scene. So, some things obviously were amazing. I think the mobility of people, even though we were all pretty mobile, we'd all lived in different places as well, the mobility of people struck me, that people would kind of live here and then move their whole family 1,000 miles away for their job. And, you know, I guess I'd always been familiar with the mobility of young people, but the mobility of the general workforce was kind of pretty amazing. And then, like, everybody had cars, you know. I mean, even at that time, even in the mid-90s, young people still didn't have cars in Ireland. It may have changed now, but there were very, very, very few students, for example, who owned automobiles, you know, when I was a youngster. But here, it's just ubiquitous, this car ownership thing. And, you know, so there were some things about consumer culture that were pretty, pretty new to me. But I have to say, I was pretty familiar with it just because of the sort of success of American cultural exports, you know.
But you're still traveling, I guess. Oaxaca, was that a excursion from California, or was that before?
You know, it was. It was. Those films are longer than actually short. I think when I first came to California in the mid '90s, I made a bunch of short films with some friends, actually with some Irish friends, and then American friends that we made here. Just young artists, and we made these sort of short, abstract, non-narrative films at the time using Super 8 and stuff like this, kind of just learning the ropes, learning the craft, and we would do screenings for our friends and so on in the Mission or something like that. And so these other films, like the Autonomy in a Song, it's kind of a political documentary about the history and persistence of autonomous forms of social organizing. So something people might be familiar with from the Zapatistas, for example, this sort of assembly-oriented, direct democracy kind of stuff. And that, there are in various places, there's very deep roots to this kind of stuff among a lot of indigenous cultures in Mexico and further south. And so I went and made a film about that. There are some scenes from Chiapas, there are some scenes from Oaxaca, and there are some scenes from Mexico City, a neighborhood in Mexico City that was developed after the earthquake in the 80s, where people just basically squatted land and built a new town, built a new suburb, and they built it on these principles of sort of direct democracy and assembly participation and so on. And it, you know, many of those elements persist to this day. So that the film was kind of about that, you know, that particular film we're talking about.
So before we leave Ireland, I did ask you, I said, let's go back to this SPUC issue. What was... I suppose there's still that aspect of Ireland which is kind of claustrophobic, huh?
Yeah. I mean, like, I guess my generation, I was born in 1968. And so, you know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, I think my generation were the ones that came into perhaps the sharpest conflict with the church. I mean, the church was hegemonic in Ireland, the Catholic Church. The priest was an supremely powerful figure in the community, and everybody went to Mass when I was a kid. Everybody, for the most part, went to confession when I was a kid, you know, which is going and sitting in the box with the curtain drawn, telling the priest your most intimate secrets. And, you know, so culturally and then politically, the church was hugely powerful, really big landowner, controlled the education system, was extremely influential around any kind of legislation that would come in. Ministers would send draft policy documents to the Archbishop. And if the Archbishop didn't like it, that was it. It would get canned. So, you know, there was absolutely no window for progressive social or public policy to emerge that wasn't vetoed by the church. And so I think it was in the 70s, a lot of feminist groups started challenging the control over, you know, contraception. There was no contraception available in Ireland. And then that had expanded up to a small amount of agitation for abortion, but particularly on behalf of those tens of thousands of women who traveled to England to get abortions. You couldn't get an abortion in Ireland, so everybody went to England. So there were clinics, basically there were, women's aid and open window counseling services that would provide non-directive counseling to women who had crisis pregnancies. And also, you know, this was also available in Rape Crisis Center and so on. And so in the late 80s, there was a referendum in 1981. A bunch of pro-life groups, I think, you know, 16 or 18 pro-life groups fronted, basically kind of fronts for the Catholic Church, generated a campaign, and it was a genuinely big, popular campaign, to introduce a ban on abortion into the Constitution. Now, there was no abortion available at the time. So this was to insert a clause into the Constitution that would prohibit the introduction of abortion, basically. You know, and this was a response to what had been going on in the 70s with various women's groups and the women's movement pushing for, pushing a kind of a feminist agenda, and in particular around reproductive rights. And so this was a counterattack to introduce this piece of this constitutional ban on abortion and ever being considered basically by the state. And so they used, then the right wingers used this, so this constitutional amendment was successful, and they then used this to go to close down counseling services that were available for women that would give them the information about how to access an abortion in England, or would refer them to clinics in England where the procedure could be carried out. And so the Society of Protection of Unborn Child, it's actually an American organization, and much of the money came through this organization into Ireland. Not that Ireland's any shortage of right-wingers with lots of money, but there was definitely kind of an American angle to it. And, you know, it was a sort of a spin-off to the pro-life movement here, or the anti-choice movement here. And so the last place, by the late 80s, I was a student leader in Trinity in 1989, 1990, and the last place that women could get this information about where to go in the UK to get an abortion was from the students' unions, because the right-wingers had closed down, using the courts, had closed down all of the clinics that had previously been providing this non-directive counseling. And so, you know, so when I say it was a notorious case, it was actually, in an Irish context and in Europe, it was pretty infamous, because we ended up in the European Court of Justice and so on. And eventually they managed to injunct us from publishing our guidebook. This was information that we had published in a student guidebook, which is given out free to new first year students who may be coming to live in Dublin for the first time or something like this. You know. So that's the background to that story, and it's relevant now, I think, because it's really bad law. There was a series of terrible precedents introduced by the Irish Supreme Court because the state had buckled and introduced this constitutional ban, which had made the right to life of the mother equivalent to the right to life of the fetus. And so then when these rights are in conflict, which they sometimes are medically, you know, the legal direction is ambiguous. And so it actually came up not that long ago. Savita Halappanavar, an Indian immigrant to Ireland, was in the process of miscarrying and went to Galway, the National University of Ireland, Galway, so Galway University Hospital, basically, which is a maternity hospital, and was refused an abortion, and she died.
And you've written about this, haven't you?
Yeah, I wrote a piece about that in Counterpunch and in Le Monde Diplomatique. You know, just tying up this whole story. So in other words, the death of Savita Halappanavar has its roots in the early 80s and in this right-wing kind of counterattack against women's reproductive rights. So, and again, the state has had, you know, the state's hands are dirty on this question for sure.
Mm-hmm. So as an activist, I mean, you brought that as part of your baggage over here, I guess. Is there such a thing as an activist filmmaker, or do those two things go together for you? Are they separate? Or
yeah, I mean, I've made political films for sure. Most of the films I've made have been, you know, born from political concerns, and they do go together. Yeah, I think. I mean, with the explosion of video, kind of cheap video technology, we've had a lot more of this over the last 15 years of people, you know, because suddenly it's a medium through which you can communicate relatively cheaply and relatively easily. And of course, with the web, this capacity has grown enormously to communicate quickly and easily and cheaply using video. And video has become, I think, because of the web and because of the cheapness and the ubiquity of this technology, I think it has become the kind of vernacular, particularly for young people. You know, I mean, even commercially, you'll find like companies that have a product they're selling or something. There used to be a handbook, an instruction manual that goes with that product that you buy in the electronics store or something, and now there's a URL and there's a video that explains how to do everything. You know, so I mean, I really think that video has become a much, 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 much larger part of the communication landscape.
So the vernacular. Tell us what you mean by that.
I think video is replacing text to a large extent. I mean, we're not getting rid of books, or we're not getting rid of the written word or anything like that. But I think large areas of human communication that were formerly catered to with the printed word, you know, are increasingly being catered to by video. So, I mean, look at YouTube, look at how people communicate in social media. Half of the links people send around are video links. They're not like, oh, hey, read this essay or, you know, this blog post or something like that. Much of it is video. And I think for younger people, that's just really natural. You know, it's really normal. So activists, sort of videos, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think from a filmmaker perspective, a lot of activist filmmakers like to think of themselves not as filmmakers. You know, it's like we're not filmmakers, we're political activists. As if there can be some distinction there. So I think sometimes the craft can get a little bit lost in this ability to communicate easily and quickly and cheaply. You know, so if there's a downside, I think that would be the downside. But that said, the fact that, you know, I meet all these younger kids in their early 20s, and technically they can do, you know, everything. They can use all these different pieces of software to create, you know, three-dimensional animations. They can use all the various editing software packages. They can know how to use cameras. They understand lenses really well, much, much, much more so than when I was a kid, you know. Because basically, to use cameras and to use editing equipment was really rare. The stuff was very expensive, and it was hard to access it. I mean, to make films in my 20s here in San Francisco, I enrolled in Marin City College just to get access to editing equipment, because it was one of the only ways that we could figure out how to edit films cheaply without having to rent, you know, facility space. Was to the education system, and now it's like a laptop and a piece of software. So when I talk about like the vernacular having changed, I think it really has done. I think it's become just an unremarkable, universal kind of aspect of communication, certainly for people in our world, you know, in the U.S. or in Europe or something like that.
So this is KZYX, our program this morning is talking about California. My name is Cal Winslow. I'm your host. And this morning we're talking to Jim Davis. Jim Davis is a Bay Area filmmaker, writer, and activist. And we've been just beginning to talk about his films. Well, tell us then, if that's the case, about the new vernacular. How does that fit into your work? If we were to take one film, Safety Orange, could you just tell us a bit about that, both technically and the point that you're trying to make in that film, if you are?
So Safety Orange, I think I'm trying to remember when it was that we started making that film. I think it was around 2000 or 2001 I started making it, and it was at a time when you know, you really start to become, I mean, I think most people start to become aware of just the vast numbers of people who are being incarcerated, and that, you know, that the 80s and the 90s had resulted in a kind of a transformation of the criminal justice system where more and more largely people of color were being, you know, locked up for a very long time. And so I was interested in that, in looking at that and thinking about the public education system, the high school system, and its relationship to it, you know, how like money and policy had kind of drifted from this prioritizing education to prioritizing incarceration or prioritizing sort of vengeance, you know, as a public policy. And so we start to look at the architecture of high schools and, you know, the architecture of high schools and the architecture of prisons, I mean high schools now that are built in the 80s and the 90s, began to look more and more like prisons. The windows are up very high in the walls. There are not the great big windows and great big kind of entrance ways that you are familiar with from the, you know, the 20s and 30s architecture, the sort of great, the New Deal, Great Society kind of stuff, this, you know, with daylight and transparency and so on. This is much more like containment and warehousing, and spatial disorientation and so on. And so we discover then that many of the architects who had been building schools and hospitals and so on in the 80s and the 90s, as money went from those areas and went into building prisons, that it was the same architects who had been building the prisons, who had been building schools and hospitals, were now building prisons. And of course, as they built school, as they continued to build what schools were being built, this sort of aesthetic form and design form was being expressed in the schools now as much as it was in the prisons. And I figured, you know, sort of conceptually, that was interesting to me. So the film is really, Safety Orange is about that. It's about the state and right wing and capitalist counterattack on the 1960s, which is basically kind of eviscerating the state, the idea of the rich paying less taxes, and then the function, the role of the state becomes much more a policing function than a kind of a redistribution, an income redistribution function. So the film really looks at that both politically, and then we look at it through this sort of architectural evidence or archaeology or whatever you want to call it, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then the last one we might mention is the Meeting Room, another film of yours. Could you tell us a bit about that?
So when I was a kid, a schoolboy in Dublin, I went to school in the city center, right downtown in, you know, on the north side of the river, at the top of O'Connell Street. And actually, the neighborhood in which much of the early part of Ulysses takes place, the James Joyce novel, if people are familiar with that, I'm sure some of your readers at least will have heard, or your listeners will have heard of it, if not read it. And anyway, so the early part of that book takes place around this part of the city north of Parnell Square. And that's where I was in school. And right behind my school was a flat complex. The city center is still dotted with public housing, what are called projects over here, we call them flats complexes. And so at that time, I was probably 12 or 13, and for the first time in Ireland, there was, you know, the emergence of a heroin problem. There hadn't really been a lot of opiates in Ireland in the 70s. In fact, there hadn't really been a big drug problem. There was a bit of pot and some LSD, and there was some, you know, countercultural ties. But they would be bringing whatever drugs they were around, largely would have been brought in small quantities by users from London or something. But there was no organized criminality around drugs and drug dealing, and so there was no big heroin scene. And obviously, you know, people were drinking and smoking weed or marijuana and so on, but there was no big heavy drug scene. And so at the time, in the 70s, criminals were making money, fairly handy money, just robbing banks and robbing, cash transits for wages and stuff like this. And so, organized crime in Dublin was limited to that kind of activity. But, of course, that was the same source of income that the IRA were accessing. That was how the IRA were funding their war in the north with the British. And, you know, they were robbing banks and robbing cash transit trucks and this kind of stuff to buy weapons and whatnot. And so the police, because the priority for the state, of course, was the war in the north and trying to overwhelm the IRA. And so one of the strategies for the police in the south was to kind of close off this access to cash. And so they became very, very good at preventing armed robberies. Their response times were really, really low. So it became much more difficult to steal money in this way, and to rob banks and to rob cash transit trucks and so on. And so for criminals then, they were looking around for other sources of income, and one particular family started to import heroin. This is in 1981. And the heroin distribution, and so very quickly, over the course of a summer, I mean, I think if you look at it from May 1981 to September 1981, in May there were no junkies in the flats, and in September half the kids were actually injecting heroin. You know, I mean, huge numbers of kids, and we're talking about children here, like 13, 14-year-olds, who were actually using needles and stuff like this. And so, of course, it transformed the communities overnight really dramatically and kind of horrifically. And so a lot of the mothers who were raising, they would have large families, you know, Catholic, no contraception, so there's 6, 7, 8 kids in the families. And so a lot of mothers with young kids were coming out of their doorway and stepping over, you know, prone junkies in the hallways, or there's, you know, just generally a nasty scene, people leaving needles around. Obviously, there's an uptick in people robbing from their own families and stealing from old people and stuff that had just never gone on in these communities. That was suddenly happening. It was as if these communities were falling apart. And from the police perspective, I think the police and the state in general didn't see what was coming. They didn't recognize this as a sort of an incipient crime wave, and a huge source of income for organized criminals. And they didn't recognize that. I think the police largely saw this as a health issue rather than a crime issue. And I think the cops just hadn't dealt before with serious drug problems and hard drugs, and they just didn't really get it, you know? They didn't recognize it for how dangerous it was. And the other side of that is the political reality that these were the flats we're talking about. You know, this is an underclass, huge unemployment, an old kind of post-industrial working class community is sort of a vestige of an earlier economic era when the port had employed, you know, tens of thousands of men and provided an economic base for these communities, and that was all gone. And so these communities were kind of like surplus to capitalist requirements and were seen in large part by bourgeois society and by the police as a sort of a criminal underclass. And so once these problems were located in the flats and weren't happening in the general society, if they could be contained in the flats, then it wasn't such a big deal. And nobody was getting too concerned about it, really. And so the parents, largely the women, began to organize against the dealers and start to picket dealers' houses and try and set up checkpoints at the entrances to the flats to stop people coming in who didn't live there, who were coming in to score and stuff like this. And then the dealers started to get heavy with the women, and so their husbands got involved. And it became this huge movement that spread throughout the city very quickly and was actually very successful in driving the drug dealers out of many of these flats complexes. So Meeting Room is, you know, the
So Meeting Room is the film.
Meeting Room is a film about it, yeah. So it's this idea that, they in the end they got into huge conflict with the state and with the press, with the bourgeois press. And, you know, the leaders were imprisoned and it all got very ugly. And so a lot of the people, a lot of the activists involved and a lot of these communities had never really had their voices had never really been heard. They were dismissed as vigilantes and, you know, they're accused of being fascists. You know, it was pretty sordid, actually, the way they were treated. And so I decided I would like to make a film from their perspective and just hear their voices. They're all getting old now as well. You know, many of them are dead. So I thought it would be interesting to have it's a social history document, you know?
And their crime, though, go back to that? When the police came down on them, what was the alleged crime?
The Special Criminal Court, people here won't be familiar with this, but the Special Criminal Court was a court set up to deal, with the IRA, to deal with...
And you haven't really mentioned, I think everyone might know, but maybe not, the IRA. Let's just take a pause here and come say, I mean, it's pretty important every place in Ireland, I guess. So just what IRA, what's that stand for?
Yeah, so the Irish Republican Army, and of course there are several different formations. I'm using it very generically here, but so the IRA, you know, the northern six counties of Ireland, of the island, are still part of Britain. So, you know, it's the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland. That's Britain. And so there, you know, there's a majority Protestant population who are loyal unionists who recognize the Queen as the head of state and so on. And there's a minority Catholic population who identify themselves as Irish and feel, you know, that they're not represented, traditionally speaking, feel that they didn't get a shake at all politically in the six counties in what's called Northern Ireland. And they had a very good point because they had basically no political representation up until the late 60s and the early 70s. They were discriminated against for housing, for jobs. I mean, it was pretty grim reality for Catholic people in that part of the country. And so the IRA emerged from the civil rights, and so you had this sort of peaceful civil rights movement modeled largely on the civil rights movement here in the States for rights, for equality, basically, for the Catholics in this country, Northern Ireland. And so that became very violent. The state, the Northern Irish state, hit back very hard. And the loyalist, working class kind of elements of the unionist community felt very threatened by this the rising political agitation of the Catholics. And they hit back very hard as well, and there was like pogroms, and people burned out of their houses, and people were murdered, and so on, in 68-69. And eventually the IRA reformed, and the IRA has a history going back, you know, several hundred years. There have been these militant formations that have fought for Irish freedom, Irish independence, and the IRA is the kind of latest and most modern manifestation of that historical trend.
So then back to Dublin, the connection when...
The connection there was... In the early 80s, you had this turn after the hunger strikes. So, you know, Bobby Sands and those guys all went on hunger strike and died to maintain their political status as prisoners of war in the north. And one consequence of that was that the IRA and Sinn Féin, the political party of the IRA, realized that actually they had politically quite a bit of support electorally when it came to election time. They could actually garner quite a bit of support. But that support was alienated enormously by the armed struggle, by the bombing campaign and murders and so on. And so they started to agitate in working class communities around certain issues that they felt they had an advantage on. And one of these issues was the heroin thing. Nobody wanted to go near it. And Sinn Féin were very supportive of the Concerned Parents group. In fact, they were the only political party that supported them. And this was seen as kind of a, you know, so it was basically seen as a Sinn Féin dominated group. And that was not the case. It wasn't a Sinn Féin dominated group. But because Sinn Féin supported them, and because there was a tenuous agreement with the IRA that if the dealers hit back violently against the parents, that they would have to answer to the IRA. And so the IRA were supporting, not actively supporting, but supporting in terms of being able to intimidate the dealers, were supporting this movement. And that was what was regarded by the state as a deeply threatening kind of political scenario, because, okay, they were able to get 10,000 people marching down the street against heroin dealers, but who's to say they're not going to get 10,000 people marching down the street because of unemployment or because of, you know, and that this would be a breach then in the political isolation of the IRA and Sinn Féin. And so they were basically, you know, the concerned parents were basically casualties in this larger war between the state and the Republican, the militant Republican kind of forces, or whatever you want to call them.
But, Jim, I still am not quite clear. Why would someone who's fighting against drug dealers and heroin use be arrested? What crime is that?
Ultimately, one of the key characters in the film, Wacker Humphreys, who was a very charismatic leader of this group, he was charged in the Special Criminal Court. The Special Criminal Court is a juryless court that was established to try terrorist suspects. And they were, you know, at the time, the feeling was and the reality was that jurors could be intimidated by these sort of heavily organized paramilitary groups. And so they got rid of juries for certain cases. And so Wacker was brought to the Special Criminal Court and charged with having threatened a drug dealer with a gun. And so he was locked up for this offense. And there was an undercover policeman there who gave evidence, and there were several junkies and dealers who were brought in to give evidence against him. And so he was basically, you know, I mean, first of all, for the kind of offense he was being charged with, which was, relatively speaking, a very minor offense, there was absolutely no reason why he would be charged in this particular court. I mean, there were dozens of cases like this being heard in the regular courts with juries all the time. But this was like the fourth or fifth time that the state had tried to prosecute the leaders of the concerned parents, and each time juries had found them not guilty and had acquitted them. So basically, people of Dublin supported the concerned parents. And so the state resorted to the Special Criminal Court, this juryless court, to finally get the conviction and lock up Wacker and a couple other guys. And that was that. And it kind of, at that point, that was the late 80s. It'd been going strong for 6 or 7 years. And, you know, it's a grassroots movement. It's like a rank-and-file movement that takes huge amounts of energy because it's all checkpoints and it's like picketing dealers' houses and, you know, being up all night. And so it's very difficult to sustain that over that kind of period of time without building any institutions or anything like that. I mean, you'd be familiar with that from your own work. But, you know, so as the energy waned and then the state was able to take advantage of the decline of their political strength to finish them off by locking up a couple of the leaders and discrediting them very publicly in the media as, you know, terrorist fellow travelers or whatever.
And the meaning of the title, Meeting Room?
So Meeting Room, actually, we construct the film around people coming into a room and taking a chair and then speaking about their memories of the thing. So there is actually a meeting room. We set up the chair at the front. There's actually a meeting room in the film, as a character in the film. And then meeting room, it's not the meeting room, it's meeting room. And so meeting room is this also a kind of the idea, a conceptual idea of political space, right? So a place where, you know, where people meet and think and talk about, you know, what their problems are and how to resolve those problems and how to work together to resolve those problems. And I think that this particular movement, because it was so much outside the political scene, most of these people didn't vote. They had certainly no politicians who represented them in Parliament. And they were kind of a depoliticized class of people who discovered a way of actually working together and creating a movement that was very successful to the point where they had to be destroyed, you know?
Hmm. So
that's Jim, so maybe refers to that kind of idea.
Right. So, Jim, anything about, can you, these films be seen, and are you now working on other films?
Yeah, so Safety Orange is seen quite, it's used a lot by teachers, actually, around, I mean, these parts around California, in schools and colleges and so on, and it's not on the web, unfortunately. I need to put it on the web so people can go and watch it. But Meeting Room, you can see, if you go to, on YouTube, Meeting Room Intro is a trailer for the film, and there's a URL just beneath, you know, the first line of where the title and the description is underneath the video window in YouTube. There's a link where you can watch that film in full, Meeting Room. So if people are interested in a social history of the 1980s in Dublin.
Okay. This is KZYX. Our program this morning is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow, and I'm talking to the filmmaker and writer and activist, Jim Davis. And we've just been talking about his films, including Autonomy and a Song, another one, Safety Orange, and we've just been talking about the film Meeting Room. We'll switch subjects now, if you don't mind, and I hope the listeners won't mind, but you do a lot. You have a lot of interests, and we want to get as good a picture of that as possible. So you write. You're not stuck in the new vernacular, as you said. You're also a writer, and I see here you've written about the Seattle conflict a decade or so ago. You've written about political limitations of NGOs, and you write for newspapers and blogs and so forth. Let's just start. We have a few minutes left. Let's just start with, this looks interesting, the political limitations of NGOs. Jim, what's that about?
So that was a piece I wrote in a book. There's two editions of the book. One is The Battle of Seattle. It came out of that moment, and the second edition of that book is called Confronting Capitalism. And so I have an essay in there called This is What Bureaucracy Looks Like. And if you remember, that was a great slogan of those days, This is What Democracy Looks Like. And so it's just a play on that slogan. And the idea of that essay is to think about, I think, the politics of the nonprofit sector and the politics of NGOs. And for me, the way NGOs are constructed, I mean, you know, to establish first and foremost, you know, lots of NGOs do incredible work going back hundreds of years. And without them, we would live in a much poorer world, you know? And so it's not a criticism of the work people are doing. It's sort of imagining... it's a sort of an inquiry into what the political limitations are. And so NGOs are constructed, are construed and conceived in this society, in capitalism, as these crypto-capitalist entities, you know? They have boards of directors, and they have tax status, and they have, you know, professionals who are fundraisers and so on, and many, many, many people have careers in the NGO sector. And so... You know,
so a lot of our environmental groups, for example, or poverty groups, would be NGOs.
Yeah.
For instance.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge industry. It's an industrial complex, you know, of this nonprofit world, and I think the limitations of it are a function of that as well. You know, they're deeply embedded in the sort of the current construction, the way we imagine most entities, which are these sort of capitalist business entities, they're built very much like that. And I think the professionalization of them, the fact that they're career-oriented, means that, you know, they're not necessarily radical in any way. And so their transformative possibilities, I think, are really limited. If we imagine what we need to do is to transform the economy utterly, and, you know, and our relationship with the planet and so on, you know, to get to a point where, you know, we can live in a just society, a just world or whatever. You know, if we think about it in revolutionary terms, NGOs are not going to get us there, you know. So I mean, they're like, they're dealing with the extremities of capitalist limitation. You know, they're like the emergency responders or whatever, but they're not actually, I think, capable by their very nature of changing up things and of really kind of challenging the status quo in a way that could be genuinely transformative. So, I mean, that's essentially it. And the essay goes into, like, many examples, and we look at, you know, how literacy programs in much of the developing world have been privatized and through NGOs, and, like, this effect that NGOs sort of partnerships have, particularly in the developing world, around implementing neoliberalism, for example.
Well, give us an example of that, privatizing neoliberalism.
Well, I think some of the stuff I refer to, it's now sometimes as I read the piece, and I certainly haven't been researching this area as closely as I once did, so I'm kind of I'm freewheeling here a little bit. But I know I wrote about the case in Bangladesh. I mean, so much of the developing world, we have very weak states for any number of reasons. You know, there's a post-colonial kind of aspect to that. There are weak institutions to begin with. There are weak, the states themselves often are colonial constructions, and they don't really make sense as political entities, as independent political entities. I'm talking geographically here and demographically. And so, and then, of course, corruption, natural resources, exploitation, which, you know, creates unnatural elites and on weird alliances with large companies in the West and, you know, local elites on the ground and so on. And so the states to begin with are, you know, very unsatisfactory vehicles for the coherent development of many of these societies for, like, a host of reasons. But one of the consequences is that NGOs can kind of, like, move in and under the guise of poverty relief or development or whatever, basically take areas of the of like sort of social collective activity that we would say traditionally belong in the realm of the state, and immediately privatize them. And Bangladesh, the literacy programs, the education system, is one example of that. You know, and so is that for the better? I mean, you know, it's like, you know, you can see that, like, oh, these children can't read or they don't have any schools to go to, so let's organize, collect money in France and get some money from the UN and get some money from Bill Gates or whatever, and we develop this sort of essentially private education system that is not controlled by, there's no way in which the local people control it, even through some sort of representative apparatus where we have a parliament and, an education department with a minister who was elected at some point or other, and, you know, who appoint, you know what I mean? So even the most tenuous relationship to democracy is missing in many respects. So that's just one example. I mean, I think in the North, in our society, you know, many of these organizations are so deeply dependent on fundraising from the rich that, of course, they're like class allegiances are going to be affected by that, you know? And the political choices they make are going to be influenced by the fact that their money is coming from the ruling class. So I mean, it's a kind of a, the piece is a, it's just thinking about some of these questions, I think, which are under-examined.
And the title again?
This is What Bureaucracy Looks Like. It's also available on the web somewhere.
This is What Bureaucracy Looks Like. So, and then let's take the last period, the last minutes that we have here with your latest, which is a contribution to a very handsome volume from PM Press, published just last year, just last fall, I think. Was it 2012?
Yeah, I think it was published early November, late October. I think it was late October.
Right. Called Catastrophism, and we should start off with a good definition of that. Now, you wrote one of the several main sections. The book is called Catastrophism, the Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth. So I think we'll need quite a bit of definitional discussion here, Jim. The book was edited by Sasha Lily.
And Sasha she also wrote one of the chapters. She wrote, so the book, Catastrophism, what's Catastrophism? So this is, it's really the idea of, like, the use of political language which suggests that, you know, things are really coming to an end. You know, that the stakes are really, really high, that civilization, the world we know it, is teetering on the edge, and unless you do something, it's going to be the end of the world, you know? So it's this sort of maximalist, dramatic language as a strategy of political, strategy of politicization. The idea that...
What sort of catastrophes might you be thinking about?
Okay, well, they're legion. You can look at... I write about the right wing, so you can look at illegal immigration.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a story put about by Lou Dobbs in the 1990s, Lou Dobbs, who had a show on CNN, that illegal immigrants suffering from leprosy were sneaking around Arizona and New Mexico and Texas and so on, and 6,000 of them, and infecting the locals, you know, so... This idea that, like, your arms and legs are going to fall off because of illegal immigration. You know, things like peak oil, I think.
Yeah.
Y2K, if you remember Y2K, mass hysteria around, like, at midnight, the clocks and the computers are going to stop, and, like, nuclear power stations are going to start melting down, and we're not going to have any money in the ATMs, and, you know, that we're going to have these external events that... You know, that transform things. And on the left, it's like external events are going to, you know, happen to transform everything, to change the playing field so completely that then a new society is possible. So rather than us doing the work of building the social movements that are going to change the world is going to change because of the internal contradictions of capitalism, and it's just going to come grinding to a halt.
Was there anything in particular that moved your group to address this?
I think this stuff has become more and more and more everyday catastrophism. You know,
mm-hmm.
And obviously in culture, zombies and, you know, vampires and so on are huge, and huger than they've ever been, largely in storytelling, right, and video games and so on, and also like in movies, like, you know, the end of the world, the 2012 kind of Mayan prophecy thing. I just think the levels at which catastrophe is being presented to us and instrumentalized have reached a fever pitch. And I think that's what prompted us to start thinking about this. Like, so really the question we're asking is, how useful is this for the left? How useful is it for the environmental movement? You know, if you emphasize how terrifying things are, is that actually going to get people to go and do something? As a question of politicization, does it encourage people to get involved in a social movement that might help change things, or does it kind of like lead to apathy?
Is that where apocalyptic politics comes in? How about a definition there? And then that's just an interruption and continue.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think apocalyptic politics is this idea that, like, hey, if I scare the pants off you enough, you're going to do something. You're going to get involved. And that's, I think, much of the environmental movement premises its propaganda on this conceit. And we think they're wrong. You know, we actually think that, like, trying to scare people and trying to convince people that how dreadful things are, and this is not to say they're not catastrophes. We recognize and we acknowledge and write about this in the book, that there are catastrophes. You know, capitalism for most people, for many people, is an ongoing, everyday catastrophe. Again, to return to Bangladesh, global warming is a real catastrophe for many, many, many people, particularly in the south. You know, live in coastal regions or where there are droughts. If you look at equatorial Africa, you know, many of the wars there have some aspect of them is related to climate and climate change. You know, whether that's, you know, groups having to move because there's no water for their herds, for their livestock, so they move into other areas where other people, you know, are already existing, and so there's conflict over land, or, you know, so the catastrophes are real. There's no question about that. So the only question then becomes, like, what's the best kind of political strategy, rhetorical strategy, to get people involved in social movements and to get people to support you if you're an environmental organization or you're a left-wing group or something like this, is using the most dramatic kind of imagery available to you, though it may be true. It's not a question of truth. It's a question of efficacy. What's efficient? What's useful? And so that's the kind of level that we're thinking about this stuff on, you know? So it's a little, an intervention there. We're not saying, hey, this is the way to build a movement or change the world. It's just a question of, you know, is this propaganda effective or not? And we conclude that it's not very effective for the environmental movement. It's not very effective for the left, but it's extremely effective for the right, because the right operates around fear. The right is really about fear. It's the politics of fear and the politics of hatred, you know? And so the left is not about that. The left is not about fear. The left is about hope, right? So this is the kind of distinction we're trying to make. And the environmental movement should be about hope. It shouldn't necessarily be about fear and austerity and stuff like that. It's got to be about, you know, hope and that we can actually live in a better world, you know, not a world that's...
Yeah, I don't know if my listeners, aren't my listeners, but our listeners would agree with me or not. But for several years up here, all we heard about was peak oil and what would happen when the trucks stopped running up the 101 to Mendocino County, and how would we survive?
We'll starve, Cal.
And what would we do? And I don't think that they meant it in the sense that really you're talking about. But it seemed to me that there was only one possible response, which would have been a kind of survivalism. And there were ideas put forward that wouldn't it be a good thing to have gasoline that was $20 a gallon, or is that?
I mean, you know, I peak oil, environmentalists should be jumping up and down at the idea that we're going to run out of oil, right? Because the carbon economy is one of the great villains in the whole global warming play, you know? And if we could get beyond burning carbon, obviously we'd be a lot further along the track to, reversing and certainly halting some of the more extreme consequences of burning fossil fuels. But that is not the response that you get from peak oil boosters. It's really this one. It's this whole idea of survivalism and beans and shotguns and isolationism, and it's despair. It's the politics of despair. And it's not the politics of collective action or, you know. And it's also this idea of returning earlier to the definitions that we were using. it's this idea that there's an external factor that's going to transform things and give us the opportunity to build a new society. It's not something we do ourselves. It's not like we have the agency to change the world. It's this idea that some other factor over which we have no control, like how much oil is in the ground or something, that's the limit that capitalism is going to run up against, and that's going to change the game. And, of course, capitalism thrives on limits. It thrives on overcoming problems. I mean, the 19th century, there was peak coal. It was a peak coal hysteria. You know, we're going to run out of coal. What's going to happen when we run out of coal, you know? And so peak oil, well, there's shale oil. There's the natural gas. There's, you know, capitalism is not going to crack up and die over, you know, the difficulty of accessing some natural resource that's been overexploited, you know? First of all, the numbers are phony. I mean, peak oil is supposed to happen in 2015 or whatever. It's not, you know. But secondly, the politics of it. Again, this is not, we're not dealing strictly in the realm of facts here. We're really dealing in the realm of propaganda and speech, you know? And so, to me, peak oil and Y2K are the politics of fear, you know?
Right. So the book is called Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth, edited by Sasha Lilly. And we're talking this morning with Jim Davis, who's written one of the key chapters in the book. We've talked a bit about his filmmaking as well. We've got a few seconds left. What are you working on now, Jim?
Well, you know, having finished the book, I've been doing some book talks and stuff like that. I think I'm looking for another film to make. And I don't know. I've just started tenuously thinking about doing something in Marin local, you know. I live in Berkeley, so I need to do something that's around here.
Okay.
So I'm not sure. I might do something to do with, you know, the coastline of Marin and, you know, oysters and so on.
Right.
I haven't really figured out yet, but biology. I think biotech biology is an area that I'm interested in.
Well, we will certainly look forward to whatever it is.
Keep you posted, Cal.
Yeah, thanks. This morning's program is talking about California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. We've been talking about the filmmaker and the writer and activist, Bay Area activist, Jim Davis. And in particular, we just finished up with his new book, Catastrophism, published by PM Press. And listeners, I'd like to thank you very much again for tuning in and remind you that we will be back here next week at the same time. If you're still there, Jim, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.